We're going to do a prayer. It's in your notebook. We're going to do Gabriel Senke, and that's mainly to set the tone of the teaching. It's to say why you came here and what you're going to do. And ideally, you're here because you want to become a good person yourself, and you want to help other people. And you want to... The best way to help others, according to Buddhism, is to become good yourself. And so you have a double goal. One is to become good yourself, and the other is to help other people by doing that. So you kill two birds with one stone. In Tibetan they say, "Deer chi ki shao ni se," which means to shoot two deer with one bullet. And this is setting the tone. That's the purpose of this prayer. Okay? And then after that we do a mandala offering. That again has two purposes. First of all, it's requesting the teaching, because we're not supposed to teach unless people want it. And then secondly, during the mandala offering, you try to imagine the whole planet Earth as a perfect place. You know, everyone in the planet has reached some kind of happiness and joy and permanent contentment. And then you offer that. And that's the correct payment for this teaching, because that's the only thing that would be appropriate for this. There's no amount of money or jewels or diamonds or anything else that would be worth this teaching. So they're actually offering the whole world in exchange for the teaching, the whole world perfect, and everyone in it happy. And that's sort of appropriate payment for this teaching. So we'll do that first. Okay. I think Chime is going to be the chanting master.
I'm sorry, I don't understand which one
we're going to say. We're going to study Diamond Cutter Sutra, and it was taught by Lord Buddha, 500 BC. And there's an interesting part right in the middle of the Diamond Cutter Sutra that says, anyone who starts studying this sutra well will start to have disasters happen in their life. Because it's some kind of purification, you know, to study this sutra, which is so precious, that all the bad karmas that you have collected up inside of you already, they'll start to come out in a better way than if you had left them there. But the process of them coming out causes some problems. And I have no doubt that, and you should have no doubt that during the course of this week, there will be some problems, like the microphone not working and stuff like that. And you have to be ready for those, okay? So there will be, things will go wrong. It'll probably rain the whole week. It'll be too hot or too cold. There'll be bugs flying around. Right in the middle of the important part, you'll start to get a klesha. You know, you'll start to get jealous of somebody, or you'll start to think something bad, or your foot will start to hurt, or something like that. And I just want to say, you know, we're very lucky. I mean, to have a thing like this here is incredibly rare. First of all, we're all healthy, fairly. I mean, we're healthy enough to have this class. We've been blessed by many great lamas who have come here. And they have taught us and passed things on to us. Many great lamas here before. So we're lucky from that point of view. And we're lucky that people have worked so hard to arrange all this thing here. Buddhism is always teaching against the idea of self-existence. And this place didn't come here self-existently, you know. Lots of people worked here. There's lots of people behind the scenes who are really doing a lot of work and pulling their hair out. And usually they don't even get to come to the teachings. First time the Dalai Lama came to our temple, when they announced it, people asked me, well, won't it be wonderful? And I said, not really, because I'll be in the kitchen making momos. I won't be able to see him. And all the people who never come will be able to meet him, you know. And that's exactly what happened. And so all the people who worked to make this possible are still over there washing dishes or something. And you have to be grateful to them. They really worked hard. This place is beautiful, and it's very hard to keep it up, and it's very hard to keep it here. So, you know, try to express your gratitude to those people and be grateful to them. So,
now that you mentioned that, Jim might be trying to listen from the kitchen.
Okay. There is a guy making momos somewhere. Okay.
He might almost be losing that
anyway. Okay. So it's very, very lucky, very unusual to have this happen. And it'll be unusual if we get to the week without some problem. So just be a tough ass. And put up with them. Don't be wimpy. You know, if your legs hurt or something, just do it. Okay? And it's very lucky. It's very fortunate. We don't know if we'll have a chance like this again. So take advantage of it and do it. I'm asking people. This course normally takes about two to three months, and this is sort of an experiment to try to do it in 1 week. It's going to be very hard for you. There'll be a lot of material. It'll be going on very long each day, and it'll be hard for you to keep up with it, and it'll be a little uncomfortable physically. So you have to try to be tough and try to hang it out and try to finish it. I'm asking people not to miss more than two classes. I mean, normally in the course in New York we kick you out, but I think here they're being more wimpy or something. I don't know. But try to come to all 10. The idea is that this is a transmission. This is a lineage. This is a lineage really just starting in America of the Diamond Color Sutra, and really not many people have heard it. The book you're going to study was just found again. It was lost. It's the whole start of a what I hope would be a long lineage in this country of the Diamond Cutter. It's extremely important. So, you know, if you only come to half the classes, then from the very first day, the lineage is like 50%. And after, we got to go 2,500 more years with it. So it's no good if from the first day there's only half. After a few hundred years, it would get down to you know, people doing it as a little prayer in a temple or something. People won't understand what it means at all. So it's very important, if it's at all possible, that you don't miss any of these classes, okay? Otherwise, you won't be able to pass it on to other people. And you should be in the mode or the mood of thinking, as you go through this class, you won't get this again. We won't have time to do this again. You won't get these conditions again. Imagine that you are like the last person in America who's hearing it. And it's up to you to hand it on to other people. And it really is. You have to think of it that way. Make your notes very nice. Try to pay attention to everything. Try to catch everything. in the state of mind that one day you could pass it on to other people, because that's the only way it will survive in this country. And so you have to be in that mode. You have to be thinking like that. You know, you are not just listening for yourself, you're listening for other people. And you have to think like that. Don't waste the time and don't waste the chance. Get it all and be able to transmit it to other people. Okay, that's the very important thing. There'll be homework, and there'll be quizzes, and at the end we'll have a final, and if you pass the final, you get some certificate. That's kind of one way to assure that people could pass it on properly, could pass this thing on properly. The homework, you know, you didn't do it since high school or whatever, but it really does work. You know, I've had many students over the years, and I've come to learn that if people do the homework and do a quiz, it makes everything very firm in your mind. And if you think, and if you just sit there and listen and go home, it sort of disappears in about 3 days. So this is just to try to get it into your mind and try to get it to stay there. And also this whole idea of the notebooks is something that you could use for your own students. If you pass it on to other people, you could do it this way. We also have a system where you can order these notebooks. We kind of give them away right now, and it's making us all bankrupt, but it's fun. And so you can get more of those if you're teaching. If you wanted to start a small class about it and teach it to other people, that would be really nice. And so try to keep your notebook nice. And the homeworks and quizzes like that, you could have those also if you're interested in it. So this is like a package that you could pass on to other people. There'll be a group of people grading the homeworks because it takes a long time to grade. On the days that we have two classes especially, we may not be able to finish them in time to give them to you for the following class because it takes a lot of time. But I'd like to introduce you to the people who are going to work on grading. I don't even know if they all know. But Venerable Jingne Thamo is going to be, raise your hand, going to be one grader. Robert Chilton is going to be another grader. Robert is also arranging schedules, like if you want to talk about things or something like that. I don't have much time, but we have a specific period set out. So if you want to have talks about things, talk to Robert. Tessie's going to do some. I don't know if you know that. Okay, well. Tessie Davis. Elizabeth Heinberg. Where is she? And Aura Mayam Sundana. Where is that? Okay, those people are going to be great. So if they don't grade it well, blame them. But try to finish it, and try to finish it nicely. It'll just make it better in your own mind, and you'll be able to pass it on better to other people. It's not like a punishment or anything like that. That's about it, all I have. Then there's a schedule that you can see. Did everybody get a schedule? No. Just generally, we'll start just before 10 with some meditation each weekend day, and we'll go to about 12. I like to take a break in the middle. We got some junk food over there that you can go have. We bought it from the East Coast. We couldn't find it in California. And you're welcome to go over there, but just please come back like within 10 minutes, because if you straggle back and you'd miss them, you might miss the most important line in the sutra or something like that, okay? So we'll take a break about halfway through. I'll try not to run over. Then we'll go from 3 to 5 today. Afternoon is really a hard time to have a class. I almost prefer the evening, but we thought that people might want to get home, you know, in time for sleeping and stuff. So it's going to be hard in the afternoon. I suggest you don't eat a whole lot for lunch. And you can always eat a lot after the evening class, because you won't be able to concentrate. This subject is Madhyamika, middle way, mostly emptiness. And it's a great tonic for going to sleep. I can tell you from experience. There's just something about this subject that puts people to sleep, not just me. And so be careful about how much you eat in the morning and the noon. You can eat a lot in the evening, and it'll be digested by the next day, I guess. During the week, I think it's what night? Tuesday and Thursday? Tuesday and Thursday night starts at 7. We'll go till 9. Okay. And that's all. Try to catch them all. You know, whatever you were going to do that you were going to miss one, just cancel it. You won't miss it much. And this is it'd be really bad to miss any of these parts of this sutra. So that's my pitch. Now we'll talk about the sutra. I'm going to be putting Tibetan on the board and standing in front of it so you can't copy it in time. And you have to... I'll put the sound of the Tibetan also. You have two choices. You can do your homework in the Tibetan. You can answer the questions in Tibetan or you can answer it in English, either way. So I don't care which way you do it. I'll be asking you to repeat the Tibetan sounds just because it's a good seed to have in your mind. And there's a lot of people in the classes in New York who swore they would never learn Tibetan who now are quite good at Tibetan, and some of them are even teaching it. So don't think that you can't learn it. It's a very simple language. You know, it was invented for herding yaks, and it's not difficult. It's really not difficult. I think it's the easiest language I ever heard of. So you can learn it, you know. Try to learn some of it. Okay, the name of the sutra in Sanskrit. In Sanskrit, it's Vajra Chedaka. Say Vajra Chedaka. Vajra Chedaka. Okay. Vajra means diamond. Okay. Vajra means diamond, and we'll talk about it. We'll talk about why. Chedaka means cutter, the one who cuts. Okay. This sutra has been translated in the past. It was translated as the Diamond Sutra, and that's not correct. The name of the sutra is the Diamond Cutter. And I'll beat up anyone who says Diamond Sutra, okay? It's Diamond Cutter. And we'll talk about it. We'll talk about why. Okay? So it's Vajra Chedaka in Tibetan. Say Dorje Shirpa. Dorje Shirpa. Dorje means diamond. Do in Tibetan means rock or stone. And Je means like the king or the prince of stones. And so the greatest of stones is the diamond. Okay. So Chöpa means cutter, to cut. Dorje Chöpa. So Dorje Chöpa means diamond cutter. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the history of the sutra. They don't get into this much in the monasteries. I mean, you can study a book for 18 years or something and not know who wrote it or you know, much about the book. But I thought, you know, in the West we sort of take an interest in a little bit about the history of the book. It's a short sutra. It's not more than 50 pages. It was the first printed book in this world. I mean, in the Chinese translation, is in the British Museum, and it's the oldest printed book in the world. It was the first book ever printed instead of written. And it was spoken by the Buddha 500 BC, 2,500 years ago. And in the world, in the Buddhist world, until the recent bad times of Buddhism in the world, it was one of the greatest books. It was studied in many countries, in China, Japan. It's obviously been very, very important. In Mongolia, for example, every family would keep a copy in their home. And once or twice a year, they would invite all the monks from the local monastery to come and read it in their home, to bless the home. So it was considered a very important sutra. In ancient India, there were many commentaries. We only have two of them left. Okay. In the Tengyur, in the canon, in the Buddhist canon in the Tibetan language, which is the Sanskrit books translated into Tibetan, we only have two commentaries left. One is by, say, Kamalashila. Kamalashila. Normally they translated these great Sanskrit writers' names into Tibetan, and the Tibetan translation is Kamalashila. Okay. This is one name that they didn't change. He wrote a commentary in about 750 AD. Kamalashila is famous because he did actually reach Tibet, and he was involved in a very famous debate in the Tibetan court, in which the Tibetans were trying to decide what kind of meditation to follow, And there was a representative from China who came and spoke in favor of one kind of meditation. And then Kamala Shila represented the ancient Indian viewpoint about meditation. And the discussion was whether you should just empty your mind out and not think about anything, or whether you should take a specific object and meditate on it. And they decided this question the old way, which is that they debated in the court of the king, and people sat there, and after a week or two of debate, people voted, and they decided which kind of meditation they would follow in Tibet. Kamala Shila won, and the idea that you should meditate on nothing, that you should just try to empty out your mind and think about nothing, was actually banished from Tibet, and the Tibetans didn't follow that tradition after that. So that's sort of Kamala Shila's claim to fame. He wrote a commentary on the Diamond Cutter that's very difficult. It's quite long, and it's also very philosophical. He gets into deep, deep things about the ideas of the mind-only school and the Majjhimika schools, and he doesn't give a word-by-word commentary. He just sort of uses it as an excuse to write a long philosophical treatise, which is very interesting, but very difficult, so we're not going to cover that. Another commentary, earlier commentary, was written by Sir Vasubandhu. Vasubandhu was the half-brother of somebody named Asanga. Okay, and these were the two, we call Kuchenyi, the two great brothers. They lived 350 AD. In the monastery, we study five great books. First we spend 12 years on the Perfection of Wisdom and a book called Abhisamalankara. Then we spend 2-3 years on Majjhimika, a book called Manikavatara. Then we spend Pravanavartika, we spend every winter about 2-3 months. Then we have Abhidharma Kosha, which we spend 2 years. And then we have the Vinaya Sutra, which takes another 2-3 years. And among those books, two of them were written by these two brothers. In other words, they have written, between those two half-brothers, most of the important books in the monastic curriculum. Vasubandhu is famous because he wrote the Abhidharma Kosha. This is the most basic text for Abhidharma. Abhidharma, in this sense, means the study of the first school of Buddhism, the first of the four great schools in India. So his book is very famous for that. And we study it in the monastery. We spent 10 years on it. It's a very great book. It covers all the ideas of Buddhism, basically. And it is the most important Buddhist book throughout South India, throughout the Theravadan country. So Vasubandhu is famous for that. He also wrote a commentary on the Diamond Cutter. You're going to be studying a different commentary, and that's by St. Jone Dharpa Shidu. Jone Dharpa Shidu. Okay. Up until his time, as far as we know, you know, we have now computerized many thousands of pages of catalogs of books in Tibet. We haven't finished all of them. We're maybe 10% through. But we don't find any other commentary before him on the Diamond Cutter Sutra in Tibet. And he also says in his commentary that he's not aware of any other Tibetan commentary. And in fact, he was only aware of Kamala Shila's commentary. He didn't have Vasubandhu's commentary available to him. Jone is a place in Tibet. It's in East Tibet. It's a part of the province called Amdo. Okay. So Jone is a famous part of Amdo, and there's a famous monastery called Jone Gomba. Okay. Jone Gunchen, which means the great monastery of Jone. It was largely destroyed after 1959. Dharpa Shedup was one of the greatest lamas from that monastery, and like many other people from East Tibet, eventually he came to the center of Tibet, Lhasa, to study. And he studied at the greatest monastery in the world. Okay. He's from Serame. Serame Monastery. Sera is one of the big three monasteries in Tibet. It has two colleges, and May is one of the two colleges. So he was from Serame Monastery in Lhasa, in Tibet. In fact, he wrote half of the textbooks for Serame. Each major monastery has its own textbook series, and Dr. Shedup wrote the second series of textbooks that I used at Cerame. So through the Geshe course, through 20 years of study or 18 years of study, you would be studying a lot of Chöni Drapa Shedev's books. Each monastery in Old Tibet kept their textbooks very tightly, and they were sort of considered top secret property. And because we often have inter-monastery debates, and you don't want the other team to find out all your secret weapons, so the books were kept very tightly in the monastery. Chöni Drapa Shedev wrote 12 volumes. He wrote maybe 10,000 pages of commentaries. And those books were all stored in the library of Cerame in Lhasa up until 1959. That monastery was shelled by artillery. And one shell hit the library. And all those books were lost. And so we couldn't find any copies for about 30 years of these books. And no one could study them for 30 years. We found one copy in Beijing about 5 years ago that was very, couldn't read it very well. And then about 3 years ago we found a copy in St. Petersburg, Russia, in a great library there. So we're very lucky, and you're very lucky to have the book. The only Tibetan commentary. Say Thailand, Chalwe, Nima. Thai stands for Tarpa. We had it last night. What was that? Like freedom, okay? Tarpa means freedom. It's another word for nirvana. And the highest kind of nirvana, which is Buddhahood, okay? Thai Lam. Lam means the path. Lam means the path. So Thai Lam means the path to freedom, the path to nirvana and Buddhahood. Chalwe means it makes clear. It illuminates. Okay. Chalwe means illuminate. And Nyima, do you know? Nyima means sun. Okay. So then, this is the name of Drapa Shedup's commentary. By the way, sometimes he's just called Chöni Lama. The Lama from Chöni. Like the Lama from Kansas or something. Okay. Kansas Lama. Chöni Lama's commentary is named The Sun Which Illuminates the Path to Freedom. Okay, it's like the sunlight lets you see the road to go somewhere, and that's the name of his commentary. Chöni means to illuminate, or to make clear. And the sutra starts out like this. There's a scene where the Buddha, Lord Buddha, is... It starts with Lord Buddha waking up in the morning, okay? And he gets up and he goes through, you know, he brushes his teeth and whatever. And he gets ready to have his morning meal. And traditionally a monk would just live off the kindness of other people and only eat one large meal a day. So the Buddha gets up, he does all his morning chores, and then he puts on his robes and he gets ready and he takes his begging bowl, we call it a wisdom bowl, and he goes to town to ask for food. And he gets a bowl full of food, he comes back, he eats, and then he refreshes himself, and then he goes into some kind of deep meditation. And then his students start to gather around him, and there's different versions about how many students, but it's like 1,000 monks or something like that. And they're all coming to him very respectfully. He sits out in a certain garden. This was in a town called Shravasti in ancient India, and this was in a particular garden that had been offered to him by one of his disciples. And so he's sitting there in the garden, and people start to gather around him. And there's one very famous student named Subhuti. I'll write his name in Tibetan. Obstacle story already. Say dan demba. Rab jor. Say dan demba. Rab jor. Say means time. Say dan demba means has time. And it's a title used for a monk. And it means junior monk. You'd think it would mean senior. And don't ask me why. I don't know. I think it means they have a lot of time to go, maybe. But Seidan Dhamma is a form of address that's used for junior monks. So Seidan Dhamma means junior monk. And Rabjor in Sanskrit is Subhuti. Say Subhuti?
Subhuti.
Okay. Subhuti is very famous in the sutras. You know, the sutras are very hard to read. They're very ancient. They've been passed down for a long time. But he's always showing up in the sutras. And normally, he's starting out the sutra by asking some questions. We have a very inquisitive student in New York. We named her Subhuti because she's always interrupting the class with a question. Subhuti normally starts out a sutra by asking a question. That's very typical. He's often the hero who starts out the sutras on the perfection of wisdom. Many of the sutras on the perfection of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita, are started out by Subhuti asking a question. So Subhuti, again, in this sutra, he comes up to the Buddha, and he kneels respectfully, he drops his shawl, which we still do before a debate, for example, and he starts out the sutra by asking a question. In the Tibetan tradition, we believe that Subhuti was an emanation of Manjushri. We believe that he is like the god of wisdom, or the Buddha's wisdom embodied in a human being. We believe he's faking it. We believe he's just asking a question that he knows the answer to millions of years ago. But he's pretending to be a normal human being, and he's always asking just the right question at the right time. So naturally, he's the one who starts it out this time. And he starts out by asking a very special question. That reminds me, there's another name for the Diamond Sutra if you're interested, and it's called the 300. The 300. The Prajnaparamita in 300. Okay, we have a lot of books on wisdom, on the perfection of wisdom in Tibet. There's a very famous one, it's called Gyatomba, which is 8,000 verses on the perfection of wisdom. There's a Nichi, which is 20,000 verses on the perfection of wisdom. We have Boom, which is 100,000 verses on the perfection of wisdom. There are supposed to have been other ones that are lost now. The shortest one, for example, one of the shortest ones is the Heart Sutra. And the Diamond Sutra is considered very short also. So it's only 300 verses. It's not written in verse, so what it means is that there's certain units of Sanskrit, and those are considered in verse. So it has 300, it's the equivalent of 300 verses. So sometimes if you read ancient books, this book will be called the 300 verse version of the perfection of wisdom.
Okay.
Subhuti gets up and he asks the Buddha three questions. He says, Chanjusembe tekwa la shupa nam ki. Chanjusembe tekwa la shupa means those who are entering the path of the higher way, the Mahayana. Okay, so he starts out with that. He says, I'm going to ask you a question about people who want to act like bodhisattvas. Okay, people who are interested in the bodhisattva track. So that's how he phrases his question. He starts out by saying, if someone's interested in Buddhism from a bodhisattva, from trying to be a bodhisattva point of view, then, and then he asks three questions. He says, and you should repeat them. Jita, Nepa, Gi. Jita, Nepa, Gi. Jita, Nepa, Gi means, how should we live? How should we conduct ourselves? Okay. How are we to live? How's a bodhisattva supposed to live? What are we supposed to act like?
Okay.
That's his first question. Then he says, Jita Dubagi. Say, Jita
Dubagi.
Jita Dubagi. Jita Dubagi means, how are we supposed to practice? What are we supposed to practice? And then the third question, he says, Chita Suwagi. Say Chita. Sam. Suwagi. Chita Sam. Suwagi. How are we supposed to think? How are we supposed to think? So if we're interested in acting like bodhisattvas, if there's any of us out there who want to try to be bodhisattvas, who want to enter the higher way, Mahayana, how are we supposed to live? How are we supposed to act? What are we supposed to practice? And how are we supposed to think? What things are we supposed to think about? He starts out with those three questions. And the first thing the Buddha says is something like lexo lexo, which means, that's a great question. That's a very good question. You've started out with a very good question. Alright. So I'd like to take a break there, and we'll come back in about 10 minutes, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about the title, and then we'll finish on time, I think. So don't straggle back. Come back. What time is it now? So 11:10? 11:15. 11:15, in case there's a bathroom line. Okay. So please be back at sharp 11:15. Okay. Talk a little bit about the title of the sutra. A sutra, by the way, means any teaching given directly by a Buddha is a sutra. All right. So the sutra part just means a teaching given by a Buddha. It's also a Mahayana sutra, which means it's based on the ideal of the Bodhisattva or working to become enlightened for other beings. And it's also called the Prajnaparamita Sutra, which means it treats as its principal subject the perfection of wisdom, meaning emptiness. Okay. That's the full title. But this Dorje Chöpa, Diamond Cutter, it's very interesting. You know, we've been putting books in on the computer, and you can check with the computer now how many Dorjes are in the Dorje Chöpa. And, you know, how many times is Diamond mentioned in the Diamond Cutter Sutra? And the answer is none. Okay? It's not mentioned once in the Diamond Cutter Sutra. The word diamond or diamond cutter is not mentioned at all in the Diamond Cutter Sutra. So what's the point of calling it Diamond Cutter Sutra? And where does it come from? Or what does it mean? You know. And it's a very important point. It's maybe the most important point of the whole sutra. I mean, you can get right now the essence of the sutra. You don't have to finish the rest of the course. The Buddha doesn't say in the book, I'm going to call this second such. It's just called the Diamond Cutter Sutra. But it's very, very important. The title is very, very important. It is probably the most important thing about the whole sutra. Without question, it's the most important thing about the whole sutra. Diamond, in this case, has three meanings. There are five steps of realization in Buddhism that you go through. In your spiritual career in Buddhism, you will go through five steps. There are five landmarks or milestones that you go through as you practice Buddhism. The first one is called the path of accumulation, soglam. And that's where you first get renunciation. That's where the first day that you ever get truly fed up with this life and this body and with everything going wrong all the time. Okay. The nature of our life, the nature of our bodies, the nature of our relationships, the nature of your job, the nature of your kids, your family, and your house, and everything else about you is samsaric. It can't go right. It's impossible. It'll never go right. It's samsara. It was produced by impure causes, and it has to screw up. It has to go wrong. That's the nature of our life. If you didn't notice it yet, just stay alive for a little while longer, you know? You know. Even if you have, for example, a relationship that works out for a long time, well, then one of you has to die first, and then the other one will die. I mean, that's the only possible ending. Maybe if you're lucky, you die together or something, in a crash or something. But there's no other future to a relationship. Normally, they collapse. Normally, one of you changes at a different rate than the other one, and then something happens, and you become disillusioned with each other, and you split. In extraordinary cases, you stay compatible, and then one of you dies and leaves the other alone, and then the other one follows after that. I mean, that's the future of all relationships. It's the same thing with all your possessions. Anything that you've been able to get that you like a house or a car or even your prayer books Oh, well, anything that you own, you must lose. In Tibetan, there's a joke. It says those items will go looking for a new owner. Because they'll lose their owner. You know, there's no future in it. There's no other possible outcome. It has to be like that. You must lose those things. Your own body, your own health, whatever beauty you might have, or vitality you have, or complexion, or whatever, you must lose it. Your ears, your eyes, your sense of taste, your ability to move, you'll lose everything. You must lose it. They must go away. There are very, in the realm of the world, there are very few things which are pure or meaningful. All of those things are something that you must lose, and you don't have to be a Buddhist or to accept that. You just have to be observant. You know, this is the way it goes. And we don't like to think about it. It's like death. You know, mentally you kind of avoid it because it's just something that's hard to put your mind around. It's sort of depressing to admit that that's the way life is. But there's a certain energy it gives you. And if you've ever heard the Dalai Lama, they ask him, oh, Buddhism is so pessimistic, you know. And he says, well, at least it's better to admit the way things are, you know. It's better to work from the point of truth than from a point of sticking your head in the sand, you know. And the fact is that everything must degenerate. Everything you own, everything you are, everything you know, everything relationship you have, anything you own, you must lose all of it. It will all screw up sooner or later. It must. It's the nature of our lives. And that's, when you really believe that and you start acting on it, you've entered the first Buddhist path. That's called Poklam, path of accumulation. There's another path, the next path, it's called Dzorlam. And Dzorlam is where you first start to understand emptiness in an intellectual way. Okay, so the big step there is that you start to understand emptiness, but not directly. You start to understand it in a thinking way, in an intellectual way. So there's four stages in that path, and at each stage you understand emptiness a little more deeply. But it's still only understanding. It's still only conceptual understanding. What do you guess step number three is? That's where you see emptiness directly. It's a totally different experience of emptiness. Like during this course, you'll get some intellectual understanding of emptiness. But to reach path number three, which is called Tonglan, path of seeing, you must be in deep meditation. And you must have had a lot of training about emptiness. And then under certain conditions, you can see it directly. And that's considered the greatest threshold of all. In the universe, there are only two kinds of beings. There's people who have seen emptiness directly and people who haven't. And the word Arya, which means superior person, or it literally means like an exalted person or a realized being, is given to anyone who has reached that point. I always say it's a little bit like virginity in this life. I mean, you can imagine your lives going back into the past infinitely. And your lives, your mind will go on infinitely. And so I like to call it the big spaghetti noodle, you know. It goes from infinite past to the infinite future. Your mind never stops. According to Buddhism, there's never even the slightest second that your mind stops. Your mind is streaming on, and it will always stream on. So you think of an infinitely long line, and at some point in that line, at some specific instance in meditation for maybe 10 to 20 minutes, you see emptiness directly. And that's a big thing. That's like losing your virginity in this life. You're either one side or the other. And that's the basic distinction between all living beings in the universe. You've either seen emptiness directly or you haven't. You're either an Arya or you're not an Arya. Okay? You've either reached the path of seeing or you haven't reached the path of seeing. And from then on, you're totally different. And they call you a stream enterer. Stream enterer means you're on your way out. You can think of samsara as a big conveyor belt. And when you see emptiness directly, then you can say, okay, this person has so much time to go. Until that moment, if you ask even an enlightened being, how long has this guy got to stay in samsara? He'll say, I don't know. I can't say. But once you see emptiness directly, you're called a stream enterer because you're on your way out. Now your suffering has a limit. And there will come a time that you'll be enlightened. And it's pinpointed during that experience. So it's very, very important. You spend the next 10 years to 7 lifetimes or so on path number four. That's called path of habituation. And that's where you use what you saw to get rid of your bad thoughts, your mental afflictions. Okay? You use what you saw, which was what? you use that experience to get these bad emotions out of your mind. Anger, jealousy, desire, thoughts like that. It takes that long, and it takes that kind of energy to get those thoughts out of your mind. You must see emptiness to get those thoughts out of your mind. You must go through the path of seeing. That's the path of habituation. Path number five is not really a path. It is the end. It's called no more seeing, no more study, no more learning. If you're not on a bodhisattva track, that's nirvana. If you are on a bodhisattva track, that's Buddhahood, total enlightenment. Okay. Yeah. You know you're wrong, but you can't stop yourself. Okay. Excuse me. Path number four. Gomlam. Gomlam. Gom means meditation, and it also means to get used to something. It means getting used to what you saw in order to remove your mental afflictions. Only by reaching the direct perception of emptiness can you reach Buddhahood, and only by seeing emptiness directly can you get rid of your bad thoughts from your mind. It's the only way. According to Buddhism, there's only one way, and that's it.
Is seeing Buddha during emptiness, is it the Buddha that you teach us about?
We're gonna talk about it. Basically, it's the Dharmakaya. It's the emptiness of the Buddha. Mostly, yeah. Yeah, Niloplam. Niloplam.
And the second
part in English? Jorlam, path of preparation. It means you're getting ready to see emptiness directly. You're starting to learn about it intellectually. At path number two. It's Niloplam, which means no more learning. Nothing more to learn. You learned everything. Just to know it all. Called Soglam, which is passive accumulation. You're collecting together enough energy to get to path number two and three. Okay. So you can see that path number three is the big threshold. If you can see emptiness directly, you're on your way out. It's very difficult. A lot of things have to be there, and we're going to talk about that. A lot of conditions have to be there, but it's possible for any thinking person to reach it. You need proper training, proper teaching. And there's a lot of lousy teaching about emptiness. There's a lot. I mean, there's the straightforward lies and people who have no idea what it means, teaching about it, in never studied it, never knew anything about it, and they're teaching it in extraordinarily terrible and confusing ways. Very common in this country. And then secondly, you have the people who have a good heart and a good intention, didn't study it well, and are not teaching it well. Thirdly, you have people who have a good heart, good intention, did study the books well, haven't experienced it directly, who are teaching it, and if they stick to the books, that's good. And then finally, you have to try to find someone who's got both a theoretical background for it and some kind of experience of it. Ideally, you should try to find that. So I think it's one of the most misunderstood things in America. In Buddhism, is that I remember reading a book by the chairman of Sony, who said, "I run this company so well because I understand that nothing really exists. I've understood emptiness, you know." And then Joanna Macy always tells the story about the lady who they went to a Buddhist conference in a hotel, and on the way out, her suitcase broke open, and all these towels fell out, and they realized that this Buddhist lady had been stealing towels from the hotel. And the lady said, "Well, it doesn't really matter. Everything's empty anyway." You know, these are classic, terrible wrong views. These are like the classic wrong views, that emptiness means nothing, or that emptiness means that you don't have to be good or bad, and good and bad don't mean anything. These are like poison. These are like the worst poison you could ever. That's like giving someone a vaccination that's not only not medicine, but it's poison. It's completely wrong and very bad. The thing that emptiness means nothing and you should just put your mind on nothing, it just wastes people's time. To say that emptiness means that you can do what you like because there's no good or bad and there's no samsara and no nirvana, that's like poisoning people. That's like giving people poison that hurts them. So there are a lot of bad views, wrong views about emptiness. You have to study emptiness correctly, carefully, and then you can do it. You can see it. You have to train in the proper way. You have to get good teaching on it. And then, most importantly, you have to carry it out yourself, which is where most people fail. And then you can see emptiness directly. That experience occurs on the heels of another experience, at the very peak of Jorlam, the second path, the path of preparation. It's called Chöcho, which means the ultimate moment of non-emptiness. The ultimate moment of life before you see emptiness directly occurs, you could say, maybe an hour before you see emptiness directly. Okay, and that is not in meditation. You do not have to be in meditation. At that moment, you see what normal reality really is. Like, there's two kinds of reality. One we call deceptive reality, and one we call ultimate reality. And we'll talk more about that. But it's only at the very final hours of the second path that you finally figure out that this reality is not what it seems. Okay? And at the very end of the second path, you understand for the first time what we call deceptive truth. Sometimes it's called relative truth, and it's a synonym for dependent origination. You see directly the meaning of dependent origination for the first time ever. You understand that things are not as they seem. You understand what you're doing to create this reality. That happens at the very final stages of the second path. That can happen standing at a stove looking at a tea kettle, making tea for your lama. And you suddenly understand what it is to be dependent origination, what it is to be deceptive reality, and what the people normally call relative truth, which is not a good translation. But you see that at that moment. Then you go into your temple or whatever, you sit down, you meditate, you get into a certain deep meditation, and at that moment you see emptiness directly. You've never had an experience of, if you haven't done that, which I don't know, you've never seen ultimate reality at all, directly, until that moment. Everything you've ever seen was what we call deceptive reality, or what they translate as relative truth. Okay, you've seen all of the objects that you're experiencing right now, right here, are in the category of deceptive reality. It's real, and it's tricking you. Okay? It functions, and it's false. It's real, and it's false. How's that? Okay? It's tricking you. It is not what it seems. Then you go into the direct perception of emptiness, and that is what it seems, and it's ultimate reality. Are you deceptive truth or ultimate reality? Maria. is Maria ultimate reality or deceptive reality? Deceptive, because you can see yourself every morning, you know. When you comb your hair, you see somebody. So while you're in that direct perception of emptiness, let's say 10 minutes or 20 minutes, can you perceive yourself? You can't, because you are ultimate reality. I mean, you're not ultimate reality, okay? You have ultimate reality, but you're not ultimate reality. We'll talk about it. But you cannot perceive yourself during that. During that time, your mind is in what we call, like, you're not able to distinguish between the subject and object for that period of time. It doesn't mean that subjects and objects are the same thing. It doesn't mean that. It just means that for that period of time, there's no way you could think to yourself, I finally did it. I'm seeing emptiness. You can't do it. You can't think that. Because the minute you think I, you're thinking a deceptive reality. You're thinking of a normal object. So that period is chula chushakwa. We call it water, port, and water. And you're seeing emptiness directly. You cannot be aware of it at that moment. You cannot be aware that you're seeing emptiness. You are seeing emptiness directly. You can't be aware of yourself seeing emptiness directly. You're just seeing it. Okay. Then you come out of that, and for the next, for the rest of the day, maybe the next 15, 16 hours, extraordinary events happen to you. You can read other people's minds. You have certain unusual powers. And you start to perceive certain important spiritual truths. And those can be summarized into four. And those are the famous four noble truths. Okay. Noble truth is another mistranslation. The word they translate as noble is Arya. It's Arya. And it means, Arya means what? Someone who lost their virginity, right? They're on that, they're on that part of the, they're in that part of living beings who have seen emptiness directly. So it's not for noble truth. It's for Arya truth. It's the four truths that people see right after they see emptiness directly. They come out of that experience and they begin to have these popcorn spiritual realizations, like in one day you have more than you've had in your whole life. And you understand the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. You understand 16 different things and more. But you have all these incredible realizations occur during that day, following the direct perception of emptiness. One of them is that I just saw something ultimate. Okay. I just saw ultimate truth. And it's on a much higher level than what I've always been in. There is a discrete, separate reality called ultimate reality, and I saw it. Okay. Then your mind starts searching for a metaphor. Your mind's automatically attracted to something that is ultimate, and that is the diamond. Okay. The diamond is the closest thing in this planet, in this universe, in your own perception right now, to an ultimate thing. I mean, you can't say this is the hardest thing in the world. Normally, you can't say this is the longest thing in the universe, or this is the shortest thing in the universe, or this is the hottest thing or the coldest thing. You can't say that. You can't pick some string and say this is the longest string that ever was and ever will be. You can't say that. But you can generally say that in the universe there is one thing which is ultimately hard, and that's a diamond. So the first quality of a diamond that's important is that it's ultimate. It's close to ultimate. It's ultimately hard. Nothing in the universe can scratch a diamond. And that's just a fact. No. We've learned how to laser them. You can drill a hole through them. You can smash them with a hammer. They split very easily. But nothing in the world can scratch a diamond. There's nothing that can scratch a diamond. When you cut a diamond, you have to use another diamond. They have soft directions and hard directions. So you try to find the hard direction of the cutting diamond, and you try to find the soft direction of the diamond to be cut, and you can rub it away through a long process. But generally speaking, there's nothing in the universe that can scratch a diamond. Diamond is ultimately hard. It's the closest thing in the physical world to something which is ultimate. Okay. And that metaphor, immediately you realize it. During the period following the direct perception of emptiness, we call it Jeto Byeshe. Jeto Byeshe means the period of wisdom following that experience. Okay. And you realize that the diamond is important for that reason. Secondly, a fine diamond is totally clear. Okay. That's the second quality of diamond, which is important. You know, if you take a piece of glass and you look at it this way, you can see through it. If you hold it up on the end, if you look down the edge, it looks like what? It turns green. It means that it has some impurities in it, and when you, if you had a wall that was made of glass that was 20 feet thick, you would be opaque. You couldn't see through it. Diamond is not like that. Diamond's crystal structure is perfect, absolutely perfect. And you could have a wall of diamond 100 yards long, and if you look through it, it would look totally clear. You could see everything on the other side. If there was no light behind you reflecting, you couldn't even see the wall of diamond. You wouldn't know there was a wall of diamond there. Like, if you put a wall of diamond around this stupa area, and if the light wasn't reflecting on it, you couldn't even see it. You would never even see it. It could be all around you, and you'd never see it. Emptiness is exactly the same. Emptiness is all around you right now. Every single object in the universe has its own emptiness. Okay? People are thinking, like, emptiness is really hard to see. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. It ain't like that. For every single object that exists in the universe, there is an emptiness corresponding to that object. Every object has its own emptiness. So on this platform alone, there's like 80, 90 emptinesses sitting here listening, belonging to the people who are sitting here listening. You each have your own emptiness, and every part of you has its own emptiness. Every object in the universe has its own emptiness. But just like that wall of diamond, you cannot see it right now. You are surrounded by emptinesses. You can't see them. You're oblivious to them. And through your whole life, you've been oblivious to them. Okay? They've been all around you, all the time. Even as we speak, they're all around you all the time. Your own body and your own mind has hundreds of thousands of them, emptinesses, and you just can't see them. And because you can't see them, you suffer. If you could see them, you could remove your mental affliction. You would be totally happy. If you could see them, you could be a stream mentor. You'd be on your way out. So it's sort of ironic. They're around you all the time. They're constantly around you, but like a clear wall of diamond, you just can't see them. Okay. They exist all around us. Can't see them. So they're totally clear. Third thing is every emptiness is completely equal. And this is another realization that you have during that jetopyasi, during the period following the direct perception of emptiness. Every kind of emptiness is completely equal. When you, as a plain old Dharma student in America, see emptiness for the first time, while you are in that experience, your understanding of emptiness and your perception of emptiness is totally as good as the Buddha's. It's exactly the same experience as the Buddhas are having at all times. You're not less than a Buddha at that moment. Your perception of emptiness is as perfect as a Buddha's perception of emptiness. It's totally, completely the same. You're either seeing emptiness directly or you're not. But once you are, you're seeing it just the same way as any being in the universe is seeing it. Totally, exactly the same. And the quality of that emptiness is completely the same as the quality of the emptiness that any other being is seeing in the universe. All of those emptinesses, although they belong to different objects, are completely the same. Okay? They are different only that they are attached to different objects. But their quality, what they're made of, what they are, what they consist of, is completely, totally the same. Okay, so no matter, it's called Dorje Sekma. Say Dorje? Sekma. Dorje? Sekma. Sekma is a very unusual word, very difficult to translate. When a wave hits a rock, and all those little bits of wave, of salt water flies through the air, each one is a sekma. When you take a diamond and you smash it with a hammer, you can't scratch it, but you can smash it. Each tiny piece is a sekma. And sekma means little piece. If you take a diamond and you hit it with a hammer, which I've done, or if you're cutting it the wrong way and it blows up, which happens sometimes, every little piece around the room is pure, total diamond. It's perfectly pure diamond. And it's no different from the diamond that it was before. I mean, each piece is purely, totally, absolutely diamond in exactly the same way that the whole piece was diamond. And the emptinesses are the same. Each object sitting on this platform has its own emptiness. And each one of those emptinesses is totally the same. It's completely, perfectly, absolute reality. No less, no more. All of them are. And diamond has that quality also. Diamond, every molecule of diamond is as perfect as the whole diamond. And it doesn't matter how much you smash it down to an atomic level. It's pure diamond. Every piece is pure diamond. It has a structure which is totally pure, perfect. So those are the three reasons why diamond is so important. That comes to you in the period after you see emptiness directly. You will understand that. It'll come to you automatically. Yeah.
Even if you don't know anything about diamonds.
You can never have had any interest, no contact, no relative in the diamond business, you know, no interest, no nothing about diamonds. It'll come to you. You know. And from then on, you will want to be around diamonds. And you'll want to keep that in your mind. Because it's reminding you, it's one little metaphor of what you saw. Because it's very lonely after that. You can't see emptiness anymore directly. You're out of it. So you want to surround yourself with something that will remind you of what happened. Yeah.
You never had the experience.
You can go back into it. During the path of habituation, you can go, but very difficult, extremely difficult. Okay, but you do. What's that? Say again? It's not. I guess it might be similar, but it's nothing like that. There's no comparison. There's nothing like that. Okay. But you would have a sort of an affinity, and you would want to constantly be reminded of what happened. So you would try to be around them. Now, what about the cutter part? Okay, why don't they call it, if the diamond is so cool, why don't they just call it the Diamond Suture? Okay. The chipa is very important. The cutter is very important. And what it means is, diamond don't cut it. Okay? The diamond is a metaphor. The diamond is very similar. The diamond can remind you of what you saw. But it's absolutely no comparison. There's absolutely no comparison. I mean, okay, in the physical world of my own experience, diamond is the closest thing. But how close is it? Not at all. Got it? It's the closest thing, and it's a zillion miles from ultimate reality. Okay? It ain't close at all. Of all the relative objects in the world, of all the pieces of deceptive reality, it is absolutely, by far, the closest thing. How close is it? Not at all. No comparison. Ultimate reality is infinitely higher. Infinitely higher. It just doesn't compare. Okay. It's the closest thing, but side by side with ultimate reality, it is just another piece of deceptive reality. It's just another piece of the normal world. It's the best thing to remind yourself of what happened, but ultimate reality is infinitely higher, infinitely more important, and nothing can compare. Nothing in your experience, nothing in your mind, nothing in your physical world, nothing in any of your concepts can compare with what you saw. Nothing. And in that case, the diamond is cut, meaning the diamond is inferior. Okay? The diamond is cut or smashed by ultimate reality. So, okay, diamonds are important, but they're only like a very poor second. Okay? They're very important, but they are put down by ultimate reality. Ultimate reality is infinitely more ultimate. It's really ultimate. And there's really no comparison between the two. And you know that. It's just the closest thing you have in your world to relate to at that point. Yeah. It's one of the ideas is the clarity, but it's not the meaning of it in this case. It's not the meaning of the hardness. The point of the hardness is that it's close to ultimate. It's not ultimate. Okay? There is no ultimate in the physical world, period. There isn't. A diamond is the closest thing to the concept of an ultimate. But once you see a real ultimate, which is emptiness, directly, then you've met for the first time something which is ultimately something. Because there ain't anything which is ultimately anything, except for that, emptiness. A diamond is just the closest you can come to explaining it to a person who hasn't seen it. And that's all you can do. That's all you can do is describe it in that way. But there's no other way to talk about it. Okay? Any more? We got about 3 minutes. Any more questions? No. Yeah. No, there really are, and by the end of the course you'll understand why. But every object that exists possesses its own emptiness. Is it emptiness? No. You know, are you emptiness? No. Is your body emptiness? No. Are your thoughts emptiness? No. Is your mind emptiness? No. In the Heart Sutra, Buddha says, "Suk tombao, domini suso, sude domini shemi, domini shemi." He's just being metaphorical. It's an example of a scripture where he lies. Okay. in this monastery and in the study of Buddhism, in the study of what we call interpretation, it's an example of a sutra which is not technically correct. You are not emptiness. You have emptiness. Okay. Your mind is not emptiness. Your mind possesses emptiness. It's a big difference. Okay. But you'll come to see why that every object has its own emptiness. Okay. And obviously certain emptinesses are more important than others in that sense. You know, the emptiness attached to the Buddha's mind is something special. Oh, when you perceive it directly, there's a huge debate about which emptiness you perceive first. And I can tell you, the answer is that you perceive Maria's emptiness first. If Michael Roach saw emptiness directly, it was Michael's emptiness that he saw first. That's the one you see first. It's the emptiness of you. Okay. Does that mean you don't exist, or you're not there, or you don't understand yourself, or something like that? No. And we'll talk about that. Yeah. You mean in other circumstances, or? Yeah. We wouldn't call it the direct perception of emptiness, and it's not purely what they mean by non-duality. Non-duality is a very abused word, like so many Buddhist words. It does not refer to the idea that there's no subject and object. The word for mind in Tibetan is object holder, and the word for the object of the mind is the object. And they are forever and always separated. And they are different. They have many different qualities. They will never be the same in actuality. It's only during the direct perception of emptiness that you literally cannot perceive yourself anymore. And that we call non-duality. But otherwise, it's a big mistake. It's a weird translation. You can have times in your life when you have an emotion of feeling at one with things. Like you can be in nature or in the ocean swimming or surfing or something, and you have this pleasant feeling of oneness with everything. That's not that experience. That experience is pleasant. It's a result of a very good karma, and it will not lead you to nirvana. It doesn't function that way. It's something very nice and attractive. It's important. It's very special. It's precious. It's a result of a lot of good deeds, but it's not the same thing. It will not remove your mental afflictions. In fact, it might make them worse. You know, because you'll be attacked, you want that more, and you'll struggle to recreate that situation when you can't. You won't be able to. It's not the same thing. It's a nice thing. It's a good thing. It's a goodness, and it's somehow similar to that. But it would be nice to have the real thing. You know, that's the, okay, one more, maybe. Yeah. In Tibetan, yes.
There were, I believe, on the Heart Sutra, and on the emails and verses.
Yes.
And on the other hand, in Chinese Buddhism, there's a lot on the Manikata Sutra, but very little on the longer versions.
Yeah. Why, I don't know. I really don't know. Chonigrapa Shudup said something. He says, he speculates. He says, perhaps the reason there were not more commentaries in Tibetan was that it's so difficult. You know, the meaning of the sutra is not very evident. And the Buddha is constantly repeating himself. I mean, it's impossible for a Buddha to speak badly or poorly. In other words, a Buddha never repeats himself unless there's a specific reason to repeat himself. But in the Diamond Sutra, Diamond Cutter Sutra, he's constantly repeating himself. And there are many strange things being said that don't appear to have any, if you study philosophical Buddhism, you can't relate them to specific concepts and things like that. And so I think from that point of view it was very difficult. And I just think that secondly, apparently in some versions of the Tengyur that we have, only Kamala Shila's commentary reached Tibet. Vasubandhu did also, but many of the Tibetans didn't have it. Apparently it was not available to them. So you only had one Indian commentary, and it was also, it doesn't talk about the sutra much. It mostly takes off on other subjects. So I think maybe that, and maybe in China and Japan there were more, maybe originally more commentaries reached there. But otherwise I don't really know. It is considered one of the most important sutras ever, and it's constantly quoted by great scholars of emptiness. Jetsun Kapa quotes it constantly throughout the, Gombo Rabso, his ultimate book on emptiness. He quotes it all over the place. So apparently it was important, but no, I don't know why there weren't more commentaries. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think two parts to that answer. One is that sometimes when you read about all these things, it seems like something that you could never do yourself. You know, it seems like these are almost mythical. And, you know, maybe some great Tibetan lamas in some cave somewhere near Lhasa did it, you know. But us plain normal American people, we could never do that. You know, I think that's one common thing. And then secondly, you hear, I mean, stories about the Buddha that it took him 76,000 great kalpas. Great kalpa consists of 10 to the 60th power times something years, you know. And you think, you know, what chance is there for me in this life? That's the first thing that happens. I mean, you get overwhelmed. And then secondly, you know, if you've been trying to practice for 10 or 20 years and nothing happened much, and you're saying, well, I don't know if this is really possible. I don't know if this can be done. This sounds great, and in theory it sounds wonderful. And I had many little experiences that maybe were that, but nothing happened after that, and then it sort of faded away, and I don't know if I saw emptiness or not, or maybe I started to get closer. I'm not quite sure what happened. Those are the two impressions of Americans, I think, of Western people. And to answer it, one is, if you have gotten to this moment in time and heard these things today, then you're already an extraordinary person. You are already one in a million by definition. One in about 2 million, actually. You're a very, very special person. If you got here and you understood anything of what we're talking about, you are in a very elite, in your spiritual life, you are one in a million. Secondly, we do have direct contact with the Tibetan tradition. You know, we have bumped into, historically now, the lineage that came out of Tibet. And people did see emptiness directly. And it is possible. But secondly, thirdly, if you have a good teaching and correct teaching, your odds are infinitely improved. Lastly, and most importantly, you have to do something. You know? And no matter what kind of pure teaching you get about it, even from a person who might have seen it directly, nothing can happen unless you practice. Nothing can happen. And if you do practice, extraordinary things can happen. The practice has to involve three things. First of all, as a foundation and as a basis, you must be leading an ethical way of life. Your life must be clean. And I'm not talking Billy Graham type of clean, okay? I'm talking from day to day, moment to moment, hour to hour, you must be leading a good life. You must care about other people. You must be considerate of other people. You must be trying not to harm other people. You have to be clean in your finances, not stealing anything, not cheating on anything. You have to be clean in your personal life. You're not fooling around with somebody's girlfriend or husband or wife. You have to be honest in the way you speak. Not to tell lies, not to tell half lies, not to give misimpressions. Very difficult. I mean, your whole life has to be very, very clean from that point of view. Based on that foundation, you can meditate properly. If you don't have that foundation, you will never succeed in meditation. And you'll always be wondering why not. You know, you'll always be wondering why can't I concentrate? It's this subtle thing about your life. Your lifestyle has to be clean. And then you can meditate properly. You must be able to get into a deep state of meditation to see emptiness directly. You must. There's even a certain level called Samten Dangbo. Among that level, there's called Nyendo. Inside the Nyendo, you must reach Mikome. Michome. You have to reach that level. It's a certain level of meditation. If you don't reach that, you'll never see emptiness directly. To reach that, you must spend at least an hour and a half a day meditating. And there's no other way. You won't be able to reach it. Impossible. I always tell people it's like a joke. If you want to make sure that you don't see emptiness directly, don't get to that level. You know, make sure that you skip your meditations every other day and that you're too busy to do them and that there's other things more important in your life. And there's 1,000 reasons why you can't do it. Your legs hurt, your back hurts, you know, blah, blah, blah. But if you want to absolutely assure that you don't see emptiness directly, then don't meditate every morning. Okay? Just find excuses why you can do it every third day and it's still okay. You know, you must reach that basis, that platform. It's only based on that platform. Sanden, Dambo, Nyedo, Mito, Me. It's only based on that platform that you can see emptiness directly. But can you do it? Absolutely. You can't find a better time or place. You know, you got everything. We got everything. You know, you're healthy. we're not that old. getting older. You have pure teachings. We really do have absolutely pure, good teachings. And especially you guys in this area. Vajrapani, the FPMT tradition, the lineage that you are in is absolutely pure. And Tsongkhapyen, and Nagarjunian, and Buddhism. I mean, you have everything totally, totally clean, pure. You have a very, very pure root lama here. You are serving him the right way. You have all the right conditions. You can't... You're in a position that no one's been in much ever in this country. You can't complain. You have all the... Everything you need. You know, you have a very, very pure tradition. And I mean pure from the point of view of correct. You know, if you follow it properly, you will see emptiness directly. But it depends on you. I mean, ultimately, you have all the other causes. You have all the other circumstances. You have very pure teachers. You have a very pure tradition. You have very pure scriptures and teaching tradition. And it's just, it's really, you're not like other people who don't have those things. All that's left for you guys is effort. You know, all that's left for you is to just sit down and do it. And you can't, you have all the other causes. You're very fortunate here. So it is eminently possible for a Westerner. There's no problem. And you won't get a better chance than this anyway. So you might as well do it now. Okay. Quick question, then I gotta stop. Okay, yeah. I'm just talking about the ability to meditate. Okay. Yeah, shamatha. Okay. Yeah. I'd say an hour, you can get away with an hour. And shamatha is a big, I mean, that's very high. But what I'm talking about is, like everything else, like dieting, like jogging, like aerobics, if you just do a little bit each day, you'll get there. If you do great efforts when you go to Vajrapani for the weekend, and then during the week you're too busy, nothing will happen. It'll be just like dieting and jogging. You know, you don't have to jog for 2 hours every day, but you must do it every day for half an hour. And you'll definitely reach, you'll become a good jogger. It's all it takes. It's the regularity and not the time. It's the fact that you do it every single day. And nothing, and then it'll be enough. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you were saying that there were three items
essential for practice. Oh, and then last one is wisdom. The training in wisdom. We had people call it morality. I don't like morality because morality reminds me of Billy Graham. Ethical way of life, number one. A good, clean, normal life, number one. Honest life. Secondly, meditation. The ability to meditate deeply. Thirdly, you must train yourself in the theory of it. You must train yourself in the plain old classroom time. And that's recognized in the scriptures. It's called, this is the Sharabhi Labha, Sakva Sharabhi Labha. You must have a lot of classroom hours in the correct theory of it first. And that has to be accompanying the other two.